Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, folks, this is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron.
Yo, Tony Pennycal.
We got a no-guest show coming your way tonight. We had had a plan to get Duke Rufus on the show, but apparently he's training like five guys for some fights this weekend. So he wasn't able to make it, but we got plenty to talk about, so it's not necessarily a bad thing. Here we have no guest. We got a lot of boxing coming up this weekend, and a lot of MMA to talk about from last weekend, and another show coming up this weekend.
We got a lot of boxing to talk about from last weekend, too. I had a good fight card, one on NBC and one on HBO.
Controversial decision, right?
Yes, there was, and I'm going to bring up all the record. The one fight was a very controversial decision, and then there was a couple impressive omnis, and also a very impressive performance by Mikey Garcia, which a lot of people were picking him not to win that fight, but I thought he was going to win. Via back, I know we didn't have a lot of chance to talk about it last week with our technical difficulties. But I've always been high on Mikey Garcia's talent.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch any of the boxing, but I definitely read a lot about the Burgos decision there that was a draw. And it was Burgos versus Castillo, or who was it? I'm probably getting it wrong.
And that thing, like, it was Martinez.
Yeah, that's who it was.
And it just—I only saw bits and pieces of that fight because I was I watched some of it while I was and the fight that I made, I heard about it.
I come up here to fight. He goes, I really don't have a trainer where I live.
All I had to do was run and hit the heavy bag. That's all I do. But you figure I'm here making $400 for this flight. In my hometown, he goes, I probably couldn't make that in 2 weeks of work. Yeah, because that shows how hard it is in some of them real, you know, rural mountain areas. And that's why you get a lot of these trainers that go there, and, you know, and it gives up. You figure, you look at it like this, Rich. It's like, even if you don't get paid for it, maybe they might give you like $10, $20 because you really ain't making nothing. Or $10 a round, I know they do sometimes. But you look at it like this, Rich. Say I'm doing that. And, you know, I have a vast experience of boxing, but I haven't worked a whole lot of corners, especially in the professional level. I want to get my name up there. I want to get my name out there. Here's a chance basically for me to get paid training, wrapping hands, you know, just helping formulate game plans. You might have a situation where you have a kid come up there. This kid, I'll say, he went from West Virginia. Tough kid. I forget his name. But he went up there one time, and he won a fight by knockout. The guy was like literally 2-15, and he became 3-15. Well, it's like, well, shit. It's like, well, man, hey, so-and-so worked his corner, and he was giving him info, and kid won. Well, maybe it was so-and-so that helped him out. You never know. But the one thing Billy did was in that fight, if you go to the replay in the seventh round, Gabe was cut pretty bad. His eye was bleeding with two cuts, his left eye. His nose was bleeding. His mouth was bleeding. He was taking a lot of punishment. And you could see where Billy wanted to stop the fight. And Gabe's father was saying, no, no, no. And Billy's like, I got to stop it. Your boy is going to get killed. I'm stopping it right now. And he took charge. And he stopped the fight. And it was a class move. You love him. The one that bothers me more than anyone, I still remember it 18 years later, was when Dave Ruelas killed Jimmy Garcia in a match in Las Vegas. And it was Garcia's father and brother working his corner. And Ruelas was tearing him apart, beating him senseless. And they were slapping him in the face between rounds. They were slapping Jimmy Garcia in the face between rounds, telling him to fight harder. So it was apparent he was overmatched. It was apparent he had nothing left. You know, there was a chance to be compassionate and stop the fight. And you need more training. Now, I'm not saying as soon as a guy gets hurt to surrender. But when you know that the guy's hurt and you know that, you know, the cause is lost. No chance of saving him to fight another day.
Yeah, that was a good move. I thought it was the right time.
Absolutely. And like I said, I see Billy in a lot of the cards. I always bullshit with him. I know the one night, which was kind of funny, you know, one of the first nights I had really ever been just talking, and it was my father, and it was me, it was Billy Briscoe. It was another guy. He was in a fight. He was a referee there. Another guy that was a trainer. And my neighbor had gone down to the fight with us. And like, my neighbor was like, how cool is this? He goes, I went to a fight card. And he goes, and now I'm outside. And I'm just like in this boxing round table with trainers and referees. And it was right before the De La Hoya Mayweather fight 5 years ago. And he goes, I'm like literally in a boxing roundtable getting information that I wouldn't even see on HBO. It was just so cool. And it was for free. Because I couldn't even ask the question. It was like, maybe I was just so in awe by it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you get to experience stuff like fights. But we got a lot of boxing to talk about this coming weekend, too. First of all, we got a big card on ESPN Friday Night Fights. You got a 12-round main event between Sergey Zenzorik and Brian Vera. I don't know much about either guy, but it's a middleweight.
I know a little bit about Brian Vera. He was an Olympian back in... was it the 2000 and 2004 Olympics? I don't have my computer in front of me. But he was the first guy to hand the loss over to Andy Lee a couple years ago. Andy Lee was a chronic fighter, trained by Emmanuel Stewart, and he was undefeated, and had just actually beat a friend of mine, Willie Gibbs, and Vera stopped him, and then they fought again, and Lee beat him in the rematch. Vera's a good, tough fighter. He's got some good skills to him, got a little bit of power, so we're talking about a pretty good fighter here. Now, I don't like to have my computer up in front of me. She's fighting Sergey Zinzurek, who I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, had a pretty impressive performance a year or two ago and was highly touted from there, and then I'm trying to see exactly what happened to him. Let me see if I can get to my my computer and pull him off. And that'll ring a bell or two for me. While I'm looking at that, I do want to bring up a couple very impressive performances from this past weekend. Sorry about that. We had one fight was a sorry, that's it in my throat. I had a little bit of a coughing fit there. 19, and I'll go through all the quick rundown. Okay, we had a light heavyweight fight. It was Sergey Kovalev, and he fought Gabriel Campillo. And Campillo made some noise about a year ago by having a fight with Tavoris Cloud, but a lot of people thought he beat Cloud and didn't get the decision. Well, Sergey Kovalev came in there and absolutely demolished him in three rounds. We're talking about a guy here who's a Russian fighter, 6 feet tall, weighed 175 pounds for the fight, 20-0, one draw, he's got 18 knockouts. I remember his fight with Lionel, and that was back in September on NBC Sports. Thompson was overmatched, but he went out there and was pretty impressive in dismantling him. Thompson was 12-1, but you know, that really didn't mean anything. He dismantled him in three rounds, and then he took Campillo out and pretty much destroyed him. The only blemish on his record was a technical draw back in 2011 against Grover Young at the Playboy Mansion. It was an accidental foul in two rounds, and his opponent Young was not able to continue. So he doesn't say a little headbutt or like a hurt shoulder, like happened in the Bernard Hopkins fight. Very impressive by Kovalev. He's a guy you got to watch out for. He's only not even 30 years old yet. On the undercard there, I didn't even get to catch this fight because by the time I got to where I was, the fight was over. Stevens, one round of knockout of Elvin Ayala. Stevens, 23-3, 17 knockouts. One big name on his record was a decision loss to Andre Durrell. He also had a decision loss to Jesse Brinkley. Looks like they were predicting him to absolutely destroy Brinkley, and Brinkley ended up beating him pretty handily. But he's come back since that, a 2-year layoff. He's had two first round knockouts since. Knocked out Ayala, pretty much caught him with a good left hook early and took him out pretty quickly. So it was another, like I said, very impressive performance there. And then going back to the HBO card, we talked about the Gennady Rosati fight. It was a very controversial title. One call of Burgess about a split draw. And then the main event of the evening was Mikey Garcia against Orlando Salido. And I know a lot of people were saying, Salido with more experience and he's really coming into the prime of his career. He had the great wins over Juan Manuel Lopez. But I've always been a fan of Mikey Garcia. He's a young guy. He's 25. He's 31-0, 26. He was 30-0 with 26 knockouts coming into the fight. And it's not like he's fought, not good fighters. He fought a guy with Rafael Guzman with 28-2, knocked him out. He fought for Alberto B. Concepcion, 30-5, knocked him out. Mauricio Pastrana, former champion, you know, on the downside of his career, I'll grant you that, but still knocked him out 2 rounds. You know, he was fighting good guys there. Orlando Salido, and had him down 4 times. And then the one bit of controversy in the fight was an accidental headbutt that broke Garcia's nose. And, you know, there are a lot of fighters that fight through broken noses. A lot of fighters. I think Vinny Paz will come out and he'll tell you he had his nose broken on every fight he had. But that's where the fight got stopped. And it went to the decision, and obviously Garcia was well ahead. Wins the title. Well, the WBO title.
I guess Salido wasn't eating a special beef before this.
Yeah, right. But overall, it was a good night of boxing. You know, anytime you have dueling fight cards, I'm not going to complain.
Yeah, that was books for a reason. After a certain round, you go to the scorecards of an injury like that. You could get really badly hurt if that fight continued. And, you know, a guy doesn't want to quit, even though he has a broken nose. You know, that could really seriously damage your sinuses.
Yeah, well, it depends on the level of damage to the nose.
Well,
there's a fight in Dover, Delaware tomorrow night. The weather's going to be shitty, so, you know, I can't go there. But let me go back to the Vera Zizmerik fight that's going to be on ESPN tomorrow night. And, okay.
Somebody that we
Now I know why I got what I was looking for. I knew he was relatively impressive. He's 37-1 with one draw. He's got 24 knockouts. So that's a pretty good record right there. And I was trying to remember where I knew him from. And I was seeing some of the names on his record, and I'm like, God, I don't remember any of these fights. They were over in Germany. Had a fight in California. Don't remember that. I was like, I knew him from somewhere. Didn't know where until I see a very famous name on his record, which happens to be his only defeat, Sergio Martinez, the world middleweight champion, who stopped him almost 2 years ago, March of 2011. Now, Zurich has been very inactive. He was fighting a lot, but since 2008, November of 2008, he's only fought 3 times. He fought May of 2010, so that now you're coming up on almost 3 years, with a 10th round TKO over Daniel Dawson. Followed that up months later by challenging Martinez, and he lost that fight by 8th round TKO. Took 18 months off, fought a guy by the name of Jonathan Gonzalez, who was 15-0, and it went to a 12-round decision, which was a split draw. One judge had Zinzer winning 115-113, another judge had him losing 117-111, and then Don Ackerman, a very experienced judge, had it 114-114. So now we're looking at a guy who hasn't won a fight in almost 3 years and hasn't fought, in the last 4 years, he's only fought 3 times. So that's going to spell some trouble for Zinzer. Now, he's going up against a guy by the name of Brian Vera, like I said, the former Olympian. Vera is 21-6. He's got 12 knockouts. He's got a win over Sergio Mora, former world champion, and he won that. Two judges had it a draw, but two other judges had him winning very convincingly. He has 2 wins over Sergio Mora. He beat him twice. He beat him in August, and he also beat him back in February of 2011. Most of the guys he lost to, look at this. He lost to James Kirkland. At the time, he was 23-0. Well, actually, this was a stretch of fights. He had a fight with Jadon Codrington, who was 16-1. He got stopped in 2 rounds. came back, he fought a guy by the name of Max Alexander, who I know from the Philadelphia area, who was 14-1-1. He beat him, turned around, fought Andy Lee, who was 15-0, stopped him. Then he fought James Kirkland, 23-0, lost by stoppage. After that, fought a guy by the name of Craig McEwen, 14-0, lost the decision. And then he fought a guy by the name of Isaac Rodriguez, who was 16-0. So right there, we're looking in four fights. Let's see, 30, 53, 68-0 was a combined record of the four opponents. Then he followed that up with a stoppage win over a guy by the name of Sebastian Demers, who I've seen before, who was 31-2. And then the next two fights, Max Bursic, who was 20-0, lost the decision over in Ukraine. And then Sergio Moro, who was 22-1. So you're talking about like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 straight fights of guys with two losses or less.
That's pretty good.
So Vera, you know, he's fought the better competition. I think he's going to win this fight. I think Dirk is way too long. And Vera's still playing somewhat of a hot hand.
On the co-featured bout that night, we have a former guest of ours headlining that one, Tony Luis from Canada there, fighting Jose Hernandez on ESPN2, 10 rounds for the junior welterweight division there. And I don't know much about Jose Hernandez, but Luis is a fairly young prospect to be getting this opportunity for a 10-rounder as the co-feature on ESPN2, so hope he makes the most of it. It was a good interview. We also have Jackson Jr. Dos Santos. I don't know if he's any relation to the MMA Jr. He's fighting Dante Craig in an 8-round light heavyweight fight. And I don't have the records in front of me. This is just from a website that's tracking this weekend's history, or this weekend's upcoming fights. And then we have Antoine Douglas versus Emmanuel Medina. That's a 4-rounder junior middleweight fight. Jose Saenz versus Jamel Tyson, 4 rounds, middleweights. And we have Josh Franklin versus Micah Branch, 6 rounds for junior featherweights there. And Ryan McKenzie versus Rayshon Myers, a 6-round light heavyweight fight. And that's going to be in Verona, New York on ESPN2 on Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2. And I'm not sure how much of those early fights we'll get to see. I guess it depends on how long the main eventers go. But we'll see. Should be some pretty good boxing on that card. And we have...
I want to talk a little bit about Saturday night. There's actually a show in Chester, PA, which is a suburb of Philadelphia, being put on by Joey I. I'm not going to be able to make it to that one, but Victor Vasquez is fighting on the card. He's a young Puerto Rican fighter. He's 15-7. Always an exciting fight, though. He's a small little guy, 130-some pounds. And every fight he's in is always just a battle. You know, you're not going to see a bad fight with Victor Vasquez on the card. Now, the other card that's going to be on Showtime is a fight that our good friend Hank Lundy was supposed to be in. It was going to be a title fight, and it's kind of threw me off a little bit because Lundy was moving up in weight. He was fighting 135, so he's going to make him a weight. And he was stepping up to junior welterweight, and he was challenging Lucas Matisse, which is a fight I did not think was good for Hank, and I'm being totally honest here. You know, we all know I like Hank a lot, but Matisse is a fighter. He's 32-2. A lot of people thought Matisse should have won that fight. His other loss was a split decision back in June of 2011. He also had Alexander down and lost you know, pretty much by like 1 point, those cards. But we, you know, come back to Soto, who was a world in 5 rounds. Last was a guy by the name of Jose Altuve, and he was 30, you know, he was a potential player of the year. Altuve, who had never been down as an amateur or pro, took shots that should have knocked over a rhinoceros. And he stood up to him until the 10th round, and then he finally went down and they stopped it. But Matisse is a tremendous power puncher fighter. And like I said, I didn't think style-wise that was good for Lundy. Because, you know, Hank is a quick boxer. He's got a good jab. Sometimes doesn't use it like he should. But he sometimes makes a mistake of trying to stand in there and trade both too much. Against Matisse, who is a very physical fighter, a very strong fighter, I was like, man, I don't know if he could stand in front of him like that. So what ended up happening was Hank had a managerial issue there, and because of a dispute with his former manager, they got the contract pulled. I ended up fighting some legal issue. So in his place, they put in a fighter by the name of Mike Dallas Jr., who I've seen on Friday Night Points. And honestly, I don't think he's going to be able to do anything out with Matisse. He's physically a little bit bigger than Hank. Fighting his career, I think the lightest he's been was 139 3/4. And he's been tied at 144, so he's a little bit bigger than Hank is. He's 19-2 with 1 draw, 8 knockouts, but he had a stoppage loss to Jose Figueroa Lopez, who went on to challenge Bell Alvarez. He had a majority of his loss to Mauricio Herrera, who I don't know much about. And he's had some other wins in there, but once again, I don't see him standing up to the power and the pressure of Matisse.
Matisse is already calling out Danny Garcia for his next fight, so he's obviously not shy about looking past Dallas.
Yeah, that would be one hell of a fight. Now, on this card, another 12-round fight, and I'm going to be honest, I really don't know these guys that are fighting here, but we have a gentleman by the name of Chad Bennett from New South Wales, Australia, 30-4, 21 knockouts, 3 of his 4 losses have come by stoppage. He's fighting for the WBO Asia Pacific Light Welterweight title against Ben Ankra, who's 17-11 with 8 knockouts. Hopefully they don't televise that one. The one I'm hoping they do televise is a former guest of ours and a very good friend of mine, Harry Joe Yorgi. He's on the comeback trail. He's had 3 wins since his loss a couple years ago to Alfredo Angulo. He's fighting a guy by the name of Bermeo Charlo, who I can't say I know much about. Harry lost that fight. Harry beat Ronald Hearns March of 2009 by stoppage, which was a very impressive performance. But in his next fight, he lost by a very vicious knockout to Angulo. Since then, he's fought 3 times, once in 2011 over Donovan Castaneda. He's had 2 fights. His last fight was a fighter undefeated by the name of Zane Shaw. Didn't know much about him. Harry knocked him out in 1 round. Now he's stepping up against an undefeated fighter by the name of Jermell Charlo. So obviously now you've got a big time crossroads fight here. You got a fighter that's undefeated that wants to take, you know, that next step up, and this in his eyes is a good, you know, this is a good mark. This is the guy saying, okay, if I can beat this guy, maybe I am a contender. This guy, you know, has fought for titles, and, you know, he's been on the, now, this guy, Jermell Charlo, from Houston, Texas, taking a look at his record, he does have a stoppage win over the Mama's Boy, Dennis Dahlgren. That was back in June of 2012, and then he also had a fight in November against Deshaun Johnson, who was 13-8-3, beat him by decision. Other than the Mama's Boy, I don't recognize any of the names on his record. He fought Chicago. He had a fight in Las Vegas. He's fought mostly in Texas since. so I can't say that I know a lot about the guy. So, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what Harry's still got left. Harry's a tough fighter. He's a good boxer. He's not a tremendous puncher, but he does have the ability to hurt you and take you out, as he did with Ronald Hearns. And it'll be interesting to see. And also, he's one of the nicest guys in the sport, and guy I always enjoyed talking to. So, I mean, nice to see him in action again.
Cool. Well, we also have the Jesus fight of the week on this card, I think. We got Jesus Soto Carras versus Selkuk Aydın. That's going to be a pretty decent fight. Like I said, I don't have their records right in front of me, but I know they're top-tier guys. Fighting a 10-round welterweight fight. It should be pretty interesting. We got Francisco Vargas versus Ira Terry in a junior lightweight 10-rounder. And that's pretty much it for the big, big fights there. And we got an 8-rounder between Julian Williams versus Jeremiah Wiggins. That's junior middleweight. We got Julian Ramirez versus Juan Sandoval in a 4-round junior featherweight fight. And Will Sands versus Herb Beef. That's a bad name for a boxer. 4 rounds welterweight. So that's on Showtime, 10 p.m. Eastern, from Las Vegas on Saturday. And, of course, a lot of people are watching both boxing and MMA this weekend. We'll probably be switching from the free fights on Fox to the Showtime card there. After that's over, I'll probably check it out. But we also have one more fight on Friday, one more fight card. Huntington, New York. It's kind of under the radar. Much buzz. There's some pretty interesting fighters there. Headlined by Demetrius Andrade versus Freddie Hernandez, junior middleweights, 10 rounders. And this is at Showtime card. Friday night, January.
Oh, it was a Friday night. I totally missed that one. No, I'm glad you brought that up because Andre is a hell of a fighter. You know, coming out of the Olympics, hell of a fighter, but it's time for him to step up in class a little bit. They've been very cautious with him. And, you know, the guy's going out there, and he's really, you know, he has a chance to make some noise. It's just, you know, it's time for him to really step up. And if he does, if he steps up, I mean, he can really be impressive, and he can watch.
And the co-main event there is Raymond Serrano versus Emmanuel Taylor. That's another 10-rounder, and that's junior welterweights there. There's all 6 and 4-rounders there. I don't know much about either guy in that one either.
I think he's a Philly kid that I've seen. Is that what you said, Friday night on Showtime?
Right.
I'll tell you right now. I can give you one of my expert breakdowns here. First with the Andre fight, he's 18-0, 13 knockouts. So you see, like, a lot of his opponents that he's been stopping and beating. Yeah, 38-18, Saul Duran, well past his prime. Angel Hernandez, 30-10. Rudy Cisneros, who was on the 1 year of the contender and was no more than an ordinary prospect, knocked him out brutally in one round back May of last year. He was 12-3. Alexis Flores, who, 16-4. No real big, Grady Brewer on there, who was a former contender with, but once again, well past his prime, 40-plus years old. You know, he beat him by unanimous decisions because he was just too fast for him. The guy didn't have the skills that he had in the past. Now he's fighting Freddie Hernandez. Hernandez is 30-3 in 20 knockouts. His last fight was in June of 2012, which was a unanimous decision loss to Aris Rondi Lara, who's a very good fighter in his own right. But you figure now he's lost 2 out of his last 3. His last win was October of 2011 a unanimous decision over Luis Collazo. Luis Collazo, a very good fighter, but once again, also a little past his prime. Before that was a one-round knockout loss to Andre Berto. I remember that fight. I think it was on HBO. Looking at a guy that in the last 2.5 years has only fought 3 times. Well, you think there, since the beginning of 2011, he fought 2 times, a unanimous decision win, a unanimous decision loss. So, you know, I mean, obviously that's going to put him in a little bit of a disadvantage there. Now let's go to the co-feature here, which was the Reyna-Serrano fight. Okay, Serrano, yep, Philadelphia kid, lost his last fight of his stoppage to Kareem Mayfield. It was 15-0-1. I remember that fight in May of last year. I think it was on Showtime. And Serrano was down, finally got stopped in the 5th round. But overall, he's 18-0, 8 knockouts. Still a pretty good fighter. He's only 23 years old. So he's got time to rebound from that. Now he's coming back, 9 months later, fighting Emmanuel Taylor. Emmanuel Taylor is 15-1, 10 knockouts. His only loss, and I remember watching this one back in 2011, which was a split decision loss for a fighter by the name of Chris Brewer. And since that, he's only fought 1 time in October. That was a decision over George Sosa. So you got 2 1-feet-in fighters here, and 2 young guys. Now, his manager, Emmanuel Taylor, is Dave Price. Dave Price is a very good friend of mine from Philadelphia. So, I mean, that's possibly the reason that, you got a Philadelphia fighter and a kid from Maryland who's managed by the manager. And now that this actually rings a bell for me now, because I've seen actually pictures of Emmanuel Taylor training. Dave Price has put some photos on there and of Taylor training with a few of his other prospects.
Wow.
You never know what happens when you get the Rain Man going.
That's quite the rundown of this weekend's upcoming events for boxing. It's probably more than we've done in a long while. But we do have a couple other little boxing stories here that I've saved for commentary here. We got Bob Arum making the news. Top Rank has signed double Olympic boxing gold medalist Zhu Shiming. Probably not pronouncing that right, but S-H-I-M-I-N-G. He actually won China's first Olympic boxing medal in Athens. He won the bronze medal. And then he won their first gold medal in boxing at the Beijing Games. And then he beat Thailand's Kyo Pong Preom in London to become the first light flyweight to win 3 Olympic gold medals, or Olympic medals, period. So he got 2 golds, one at the Beijing Games and 1 in London. And he's a light flyweight. He's the first light flyweight to win 3 Olympic medals, period, from any country, I guess. It doesn't say it from China, so that's interesting. Arum's stable of fighters also obviously includes world champion, 8 division world champion Manny Pacquiao and WBO welterweight title holder Timothy Bradley. And said Zhu is an incredible talent who is beloved in the People's Republic of China. We at Top Rank will make every effort to make certain that he has a spectacular career as a professional boxer. Zhu is 31 years old, and he also captured medals in the World Amateur Championships in 2005, 2007, and 2011. And just when you thought that South African Francois Botha would never be in a big fight again, he has signed to fight a guy named Sonny Bill Williams. And we talk a lot in America about how the best athletes end up in football. Well, in some of these countries like Australia, the best athletes end up in rugby. And this Sonny Bill Williams is a pretty famous rugby player down there in Auckland. Actually, he was training in Auckland. I'm not sure if he's played Auckland. But he's now training down there in Auckland for a fight with Francois Botha, who was a pretty big heavyweight back in the day, both literally and figuratively. this is going to be a February 8th fight in Brisbane, Australia. And the New Zealand Rugby Union would really love to have the 27-year-old available again for the next World Cup. But in the meantime, you know, this Sonny Billy Williams is going to be focusing on this fight. Both of us, 44 years old, also known fondly as the White Buffalo. Step up in class for New Zealand heavyweight champion Williams. And at the very least, he should be able to take a punch, which hasn't always been the case with Williams' opponents. Botha's record is 48 wins, 8 losses, and Williams' 5 wins. His experience speaks for itself, said Williams, who is an Auckland seeing family. For me, in a boxing sense, I need to take the fights like this to move up. It's definitely going to put my name out there internationally if I win, because it's for an international WBA belt. The fight was originally scheduled for last year, but was put back due to Williams' chest injury he suffered while playing for his Panasonic club in Japan. So there you have it. That's a story down there from New Zealand.
Two things that what we should remember about Williams, he's a tough guy, you know. If you look at it, I mean, he looked like a buffalo. You know, a broad chest. You know, tough guy. The two things I'll always remember about his career, one was obviously his fight with Mike Tyson. He was beating Tyson after 4 rounds. That was when Tyson was getting frustrated and, like, tried to snap his arm in a clinch. Then Tyson caught him with a big right hand in the fifth and knocked him out cold. But even before that, even before I'd even ever seen the guy fight, and why something like this sticks out in my mind, I don't know. But it does. I just remember reading a Ring magazine. And he was at a press conference, he was challenging somebody. He's like, I'm the White Buffalo, and they say I'm like the White Muhammad Ali, and I move like Ali, and I fight like Ali. And someone, and then Ring Magazine was like, exactly who ever said this? Because the guy, and you know, he was a tough fighter, and, you know, he went out there and fought a lot of good fighters, but I don't think I could find somebody that was more un-Ali-ish.
Wow. Somebody from his era. Your Holyfield's looking for a fight, so I guess he's got to have a belt, though. Holyfield's got to fight him. But maybe the WBA international belt if he wins will be enough. A couple events to talk about from this past weekend in mixed martial arts. I'm going to try to wait for Tom, if he comes on a little bit later, to recap those. But we got a couple other stories here. One interesting one this week we were on for an extended period. We had the extra show that we had to do, but I didn't watch it after we got off. And I saw the main event between Rick Khan and I think Michael Chandler. Apparently, it was with Rick Khan's sponsor. down. Sponsor. They get to pay him for the sponsorship agreement they had after the bout. And hang on one second, I'll find it. They set a change in. Lightweight title fight. So it's not like he lost to a ball or anything. Okay. I'm not letting me get to the story here. Okay. So, it was Rick Hahn versus Michael Chandler for the lightweight title. And Rick came up short in his bid to capture the crown. He ended up getting caught in a second-round rear naked choke. And according to Hahn, he lost a payday from one of his main sponsors, who was so disappointed that he didn't win that they put a stop payment on his check, because great TV exposure holds no weight in defeat. Hahn went out on Twitter. At this point, a stop payment has been placed on check, which cannot be cashed or deposited now. I will not comment on Rick and his fight. That's not my place. But what I will tell you is this. I took a huge chance with him. TV exposure was great, but it only holds weight if he wins or puts on a good show. Neither happened. At the end of the day, not one soul will run to my store and buy product because they saw my logo and saw Rick lose the fight. I've made it my career and business to know what nets a return on investment for the brand, and this is the number one reason why I do not hand out money or product to fighters. Hahn competed at the 2004 Olympics in judo and has a 14-2 record overall, not to mention he was in the main event that I mentioned. And it's not like he was beaten by some bum, as I also said. Chandler is one of the top 155-pounders not competing for Zuffa. And apparently Hahn was quick to be unable to comment or identify the sponsor in question when contacted by MMAmania.com. And the update on the story, lifestyle brand HTFU, I guess, was the identified sponsor, and they agreed to pay Hahn the sponsorship money he was owed after a, quote, miscommunication. Basically, the guy who runs the company, named Gingrich, was quite emotional when talking about the personal threats he has received from MMA fans since Hahn posted this message Monday. And he said the last thing he wants people to think is that his brand doesn't support athletes when they fall short. He reiterated that he regrets the miscommunication and wished Hahn the best in his career. All's well that ends well, I guess. But it brings up some interesting arguments there. And I'm responding to it as a business owner. And it also shows that the MMA fan base can have a lot of power when they want to throw it around. So when you see an injustice like that, and you take action, and you not advocating death threats and that kind of stuff, but you know, apparently the backlash was bad enough that this company decided to do something that they didn't want to do. But you know, I think they would have lost the lawsuit around longer anyway. That's just one of those weird stories that came up. Bellator is a pretty big brand. Spike is a pretty big TV station, so I don't understand why somebody would risk that kind of backlash by pulling that kind of a move, but I doubt it's the first time it's happened. Anyway, there was an article here, of course, on Yahoo by David King. MMA's fighter pay problem. And basically, it's outlined a concern that I've had for a long time about you know, how some of these lower-tier guys get paid a lot less. And we brought this up with Rampage Jackson last week, talking about how some of these guys can't even afford to pay their sparring partners. But this article basically outlines how bad it can really be. And I'm just going to read it straight. right from the beginning. It takes a lot of hard work and dedication to excel in MMA, and a large number of mixed martial artists barely make more than the U.S. minimum wage when you factor in all the hours of training necessary to be successful. Of course, the big names make a pretty good living, but even folks like current UFC middleweight champion Anderson Silva and welterweight champion George St. Pierre are still greatly underpaid. Compared to athletes of similar stature in other sports. MMA is obviously still in its infancy, so it's a little unfair to compare it to the major sports. Fighter pay has gotten better with the growth of mixed martial arts, not as much as it should have. No one has it worse in MMA than the newly trained professional, turned professional fighter. For the person who decides to give MMA a try, getting paid $1,000 for their first handful of professional fights isn't out of the norm, and some even have to settle for lesser purses. To make things worse, sponsors aren't exactly lining up to paste their logos on unknown fighters performing in front of a few hundred folks, so most newbie pros don't have that extra income coming in. At that pay scale, even if a fighter fights 6 times a year and wins all his or her fights, assuming pay is doubled if they win, that's only $12,000 a year. And that's before training dues and manager fees, healthcare costs, and, of course, Uncle Sam and taxes. Flipping burgers at a fast food joint, getting paid the U.S. minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, makes about $14,500 a year, assuming they take a two-week vacation, without having to worry about broken bones and serious head trauma. For that very reason, most low-level MMA fighters have regular jobs, since it's virtually impossible to get by with their earnings from fighting. The fortunate ones are able to make money with the knowledge they've acquired as martial artists by teaching classes or such, while others are forced to get regular jobs like everyone else. Things get a bit better as MMA fighters move up the rankings. Mid-tier fighters make about $10,000 to $30,000 a fight, and getting sponsors at that stage becomes a lot easier. As long as they win a majority of their fights, they can expect to make the same amount as college-educated professionals. However, given the amount of effort MMA fighters put into training and the life-lasting injuries they pick up over the years, it still seems like a crappy deal. Without sponsors or other side income, a decent amount of mid-tier fighters wouldn't be able to make, and MMA fighters be paid. The UFC is clearly the premier MMA organization in the world, and their fighters are also the highest paid. On one hand, the UFC seems to take better care of their athletes than any other mixed martial arts promotion. But on the other hand, their fighters only get a small fraction of the profits generated. For example, the UFC 155 fight card generated a live gate of about $3.2 million, while the total disclosed fighter payout was about $1.3 million. Even if the promotion paid out an extra $1 million in undisclosed earnings, that still leaves them with $900,000. The pay-per-view numbers for UFC 155 haven't been released, but even with a conservative 500,000 buys, estimated at $44.99 a buy, that's another $22.5 million, and there's advertising income and sponsor taxes. Of course, the UFC also has a lot of expenses, but when you look at the numbers, it's obvious the company is raking in some serious profits. Given how well the UFC is, they'll have serious competition anytime soon. That means it's up to the fighters to figure out how much their services are worth and demand appropriate compensation. It's hard to see that happening without most of the top fighters in the UFC teaming up to form a union. Athletes in major organizations like the NBA, MLB, and NFL have established unions, and the results are clear. Until the 2011 lockout, NBA players received 57% of basketball-generated income. They now get 51%, if you're wondering. It's impossible to put a number on exactly how much of the revenue generated by the UFC goes to the fighters, since the promotion doesn't disclose its earnings, but it's certainly nowhere close to 51%. That means the most promising young athletes in the world will continue to pursue other sports where they'll have more control of their careers, get paid a lot more money, and perhaps a pension when their careers are over. And the author is a Brazilian jiu-jitsu and boxing practitioner who has watched and studied MMA for the past 8 years. It's probably one of the best short little articles that I've seen written about the pay structure. And it's definitely an issue that keeps surfacing in the face of these stories. The millionaires here. And comfort. It's an argument that a lot of those, not necessarily your bonuses, a lot of the millions these guys get are from sponsorship agreements. And I think the highest total pay I've ever seen anybody get for one single MMA match, base pay with a win bonus, was $500,000. So it's not like the boxing world. I know boxers don't probably get as many sponsors as MMA fighters, but it seems like they definitely, when they get to a higher level, they get paid a lot more per fight.
Yeah. I mean, with boxers, I mean, sometimes you'll see where, like, I know Oscar doesn't hold it for the longest time. He's got, like, a Budweiser logo on his trunks. Sometimes you'll see guys, I remember back in the day, now, granted, I'm going back in the day here when boxing was, you know, more available on free networks like NBC and ABC on the Saturday afternoons, but you would see guys like Sugar Ray Leonard would always be promoting Franklin products. He'd always have them on the trunks or whatever. I mean, now you'll see guys, I mean, like, you don't see any, like, most ringside title, or if a person goes to, like, a private, you know, tailor to get their, you know, stuff made. But yeah, back in the day, Sugar Ray Leonard always had Franklin. I'm trying to remember who always used, I think it was Larry Holmes always used something like Pony. And then, like I said, with De La Hoya, he always had, like, the Budweiser. The guys you probably want to look at right now, I would look at guys like Mayweather, Pacquiao, to see, look at their trunks to see at the time if they have any endorsements on there. I remember a guy by the name of Julie Francis back then, I think it was back in 2000, he was fighting Mike Tyson, and he had a company actually buy advertising on the soles of his boots. Yeah. Back in 2001, you don't see anybody do it anymore, but Bernard Hopkins was the first to do it when he had the GoldenPalace.com temporary tattoo on his back. And here's what Hopkins did, because, you know, in not like baseball, like when Pete Rose gets banned from the Hall of Fame for betting on some games, Bernard Hopkins got paid $100,000 from GoldenPalace.com to do that, and he turned that $100,000 and wagered it on himself at 3.5-1 odds. And he won. It was for a while that started where a lot of guys were doing that, and then unfortunately, maybe fortunately, I don't know. You don't see that as much anymore.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily this promoters that put the swash on that, but
maybe
I know that shows are typically promoted by, you know, obviously big-name promoters, some of them corroborating, but usually they have sponsors of the whole event, like the beer sponsors and stuff like that. And, so if there was a conflicting sponsor, it would be in one of maybe, you know, three big categories. But in the UFC, you have, you know, the official freaking corn nuts of the UFC. So there's so many different sponsors who get these exclusive agreements. And fighters are seemingly constantly running into these conflicts where they can't even wear their sponsor stuff into the ring. But you see the big difference in boxing and MMA and sponsorships when, you know, the boxer comes to the ring, doesn't have a poster with him with all his sponsors on it that is his team for the ropes. But in MMA, every fighter has one. Or at least in the UFC that I remember, you know, from watching about every card recently, you see a guy with a big poster coming in with the entourage, and, you know, when the guy gets introduced, he's standing in front of his poster with all the sponsors on it. So it's a big factor in MMA fighter pay to get these sponsorships. And the UFC doesn't disclose how much they make off of these guys either, because they, I think they had come come up with a policy in the very beginning when they decided to do it of charging like a $50,000 gateway fee for these big-time sponsors. And I think it's actually more for some of the bigger ones. And basically it's, you know, pay up or you can't sponsor any of our fighters. And I don't know whether that relates to only for, you know, store stuff the fighter actually wears into the cage or if it's just period, you know, sponsor them in any capacity. But I know that some people have said they've been able to get around that, sponsors. So there's got to be some kind of loophole to that. But I'm not sure what the exact deal is. But either way, the company makes a ton of money off their fighters. And they're not paying them enough, especially these lower-tier fighters. So it's definitely something that needs to improve. And we'll be taking a look at it, I'm sure, again in the future. And then the other aspect of it is, you know, they do have the health insurance and stuff like that, but what happens when you have an injury that puts you out of fighting for a while? Yeah, you get your health care paid for, but how are you going to earn? You know, these guys that don't have any kind of day job to fall back on, or their sponsors aren't going to pay them not to fight. So it's a tough situation for some of these guys to have to deal with that kind of reality. And the injuries, I think we're going to find out in the long run, are a lot worse to deal with for MMA fighters than they are for boxers. Boxers, you can have broken ribs, you can have a busted arm, you can have a busted nose, all that stuff. But, you know, for MMA fighters, anywhere from the tip of your head to the tip of your toes, you get injured. And it's not a matter of, you know, public record, how many serious injuries these guys sustain in a typical year. But once we start getting these studies out about not just brain damage, but overall injury rates between the two sports, you know, I think that boxing actually is a lot better than MMA in that respect. There's two different types of combat there. And in boxing, I think you tend to get the pugilistic dementia and, you know, long-term injuries from too many sustained punches to the head over a long career. Whereas in MMA, you get cuts, deep cuts, and concussions, and broken bones, and, you know, a whole host of things. And these guys don't always get injured in the big spotlight fight either. Sometimes it's in the gym, so you know, it doesn't always get publicized. But speaking of injuries, to move on here, I would like to talk about a little bonus that Dana White gave out to Joe Lauzon, who was pretty seriously injured by Jim Miller in his last fight. In the case of Lauzon, did he take? Did he give Lauzon the $65,000 chunk of bonus money for his blood-soaked war against Miller? But he also was able to take home an incredible souvenir. Dana White actually sent Lauzon the actual canvas from UFC 155, which now resides in Lauzon's gym.
Oh, wow.
One Twitter commenter from Lauzon's page where he posted the photo said, DNA test confirm, the mat is definitely yours. It's got blood over it. And the battle would go on to be known as the 2012 Fight of the Year. Jim Miller won the contest by unanimous decision. I didn't actually get to see the fight. I saw a couple highlights, but it was the one fight on that card. I missed virtually the whole thing. And Lauzon actually has a record 12 fights for Octagon performances, and he shares the top honors there with Anderson. Win or lose, he's a very entertaining fighter. I've seen him in person, met him, he's a good guy, and I'm sure a lot of those guys that go to his gym will be inspired to see that UFC man on the floor. And of course, we wouldn't be able to get through a week of this show without talking about performance-enhancing drugs, always a hot button issue in combat sports. And a controversial guy for another UFC situation that was kind of puzzling, called referred to as the three strikes and you're out rule. Well, as we mentioned before in the past, in the whole Zion story, this is a story from Dan Hardy, who had four losses in a row. Granted, a lot of them were against top-tier talent, but four losses in a row, and he didn't throw them out. And his last loss in that stretch was against Chris Lytle. And he did go out with a bang there. He fought tough in that fight, but he ended up losing. And it was actually Lorenzo Fertitta who was the first to come out and say, we're not cutting. And of course, Lorenzo Fertitta is head of Fertitta Enterprises, which now owns Zions Incorporated. So it was not a coincidence to me that he was the one to make sure that Hardy was saved. At that time, Hardy, I think, was on like millions of cans of Zenergy. So you don't want to throw a guy out of the UFC when he's representing one of the sponsor's brands like that. The UFC, you know, Lance Armstrong issue has gotten a lot of people talking about doping and drugs and PEDs and all that. So Dan Hardy went out on Twitter and acknowledged the rampant use of cheating in MMA. And he says, every single elite-level athlete's on the same page. They all dope. Not all of them, but yes, most do for sure. And Brit doesn't seem terribly concerned by the epidemic as he continually fielded questions on the subject. And he also stated that he knows several of his previous opponents have been on the juice. And he asked one Twitter user, would you fight someone knowing they had been using enhancing drugs or steroids? Already have, lots of times. And Hardy does not seem convinced that voluntary anti-doping tests could potentially save this poor. And this is interesting to a guy named Ben Bergeron. No relation. But he says, at Ben Bergeron, are you or will you sign up for VADA? Hell no. I don't trust that nonsense any more than the guy I'm fighting. Hardy did take time to acknowledge that some fighters who utilize controversial testosterone replacement therapy allowances truly need it. However, he mixes no word when pointing out that others use it without any necessity. He says, I've seen both sides, guys that need it and guys that use it. If you need it, cool. Currently, Hardy is scheduled to meet Matt Brown at the upcoming UFC on Fox 7 in April. He hopes to improve upon a two-fight winning streak. And he last saw his arm raised against Amir Sadala and Dwayne Ludwig in 2012. Here's the boxing story we forgot to mention. It came out last Saturday. Retirement at 30 years old. There's a lot of big-name guys talking about wanting to fight him, but apparently he doesn't want to fight anybody anymore. The 30-year-old native of Youngstown, Ohio, became the undisputed middleweight champion by beating Jermaine Taylor back in 2007 in an effort that saw him pull himself off the canvas to stop the defending WBCO and WBC and WBO titleist. And from there, the entertaining and affable blue-collar battler seemed on the road to mainstream stardom before his injury and a well-publicized drinking problem turned a two-year chunk of career into a mess of canceled fights and subpar performances. But Pavlik was a hard fighter to keep down, both inside and outside the ring. He fought through adversity in order to make another run at the main stage with a new trainer, Robert Garcia. However, it was clear that the fire was no longer there. Listless performances against second- and third-tier tune-ups brought down his stock considerably, and the recently canceled Andre Ward, 168-pound championship bout, would likely have been an ugly one-sided affair if Pavlik couldn't muster at least some of his old enthusiasm. And Pavlik says, when you stay in the sport too long, you have health problems. That's a big, big thing for me. I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about in the future. I'm talking about when I'm 55 or 60. What's going to happen to me then? And why take any more chances, especially in that sport? It's a brutal sport. You never know what could happen. I won the world title. I defended my title. I was champ for 3 years, and I made good money. Why take the chance of medical problems? That's a big part of it. I also don't think the drive is there anymore. I'm moving on to a new chapter in my life. Pavlik insists that he's fine economically with a partnership in a shopping mall and plans to open a gym in the near future, and that the desire to spend more time with his wife and two children is the real driving force behind his plan to retire. He's also making it clear that his past struggle with alcohol abuse has nothing to do with the decision to hang up the gloves. The former world titleist leaves behind a 12-year professional career and a record of 40-2 with 34 KOs, highlighted by wins over Jermaine Taylor twice, Edison Miranda, Marco Antonio Rubio, Jose Luis Sertouche, Bronco McCart, and Fulgencio Zuniga. His losses were a shockingly one-sided decision loss to Bernard Hopkins and a spirited, blood-spattered decision loss to Sergio Martinez, which will also go down in the career ledger of the Ernest Two-Fisted fighter from Youngstown. Pavlik's biggest legacy, though, may be that of a fighter who got out at the right time and for the right reasons. From the perspective of a fight fan, the loss of a compelling performer is never a good thing, but Pavlik was smart enough to recognize that the fire was gone and realistic enough to know when he was done as a main stage fighter. And everyone should be fine with his decision. Pavlik also said, I'm tired of leaving my family for training camp. It comes to a point when you just don't want to do that anymore. My family is more important at this stage. I had a pretty good career. I was 40-2, and I only lost to two of the best guys, Martinez and Hopkins. I'm content.
Now, you know, he was tall, he was kind of lanky, he got long arms, you know, he was a relatively thin guy, almost like he was a little bit pigeon-chested, but he could fight. He got a game top somehow. But the fight really put
kind of around me. And
may not want to turn around. But here's why Joe's not being killed. Because how is Joe going to no fear and be out now? I could take the same car on Corey Spinks, who probably couldn't know a 4-year-old kid in the did not press the action, and as predicted, came out with a knockout. Oh, I did predict that Pavlik fought a little bit more aggressively, took him the distance this time with Pavlik winning in a close fight. The Hopkins fight actually caught me off guard because Hopkins had a very good performance against Joe Calzaghe earlier in the year, and he really looked more of his age that night. Hopkins, he just seemed like he was having trouble with stamina in that fight, and I'm like, all right, Hopkins might be starting to catch up, but I think Pavlik's pressure might allow him to win rounds, not hurt Hopkins. Definitely not stop Hopkins, but win rounds and win the decision. It was wrong because, as Hyde Weir, his best performances are against the guys that are very straightforward and aggressive. But with that, all that being said, I enjoyed Kelly Pavlik's career. I enjoyed watching him fight. I'm glad he's going out healthy. He fought with Sergio Martinez, who was very good. I thought he had the momentum until he got cut, and I think that cut really affected him in the last three rounds, allowed Martinez to win. But, I wish him the best. I wish him the most health and good finances, and, I thank him as a boxing fan for what he gave to us.
All right. I second that emotion, and we have Psychic Tom Patchett on the line with us. Mr. Tax.
Yeah, sir. Boy, I'd like to weigh in on that, but Tony summed it up so good. It's hard to even add anything. I can just say I'm a little saddened, but I understand it, and it's not completely shocking to me that he just took stock of where he's at. Maybe just looked around and said maybe it's time to leave.
Yeah, it's probably a good time for him. And you don't think they have it anymore. It's always a good move to not do it for the money, just get out and protect your health.
Because you remember that old cliche, boxing is not the kind of sport to hang around in just to say you're hanging around.
Right. Well, now that we have Tom on, of course, we have a lot of MMA stuff to talk about that we didn't get to yet. The big one being the two UFC cards, the one that just happened and the one coming up. Michael Bisping got knocked the heck out, basically, by Vitor Belfort. The head kick and some punches in round. Bisping was doing a lot better in the first round, but Belfort just bided his time, and he just kept landing that nice head kick, and took him just a minute and 27 seconds into the second round to take out Bisping. And at first, I thought Bisping was protesting the decision to stop it, but he's actually come out in public afterwards and said that it was fair. That's just a bad day for him, and he took all the blame for losing that fight. And also, Belfort has apparently tried to spur a rematch with John Jones off this performance, and Jones has already shot that down. So.
Yeah, I think Vitor's got a little bit of climbing back to do, but, to use this phrase, referring to my notes, to show you what a moron I felt like that night. I'm just making a comment that Bisping seldom makes a mistake. Well, now it's about 10 seconds before the kick landed. Oh, wow. But, I really think this is going to be awful hard for Bisping because Vitor was on the verge of being a gatekeeper, and I won't say Bisping's there yet, but this was not, this is going to be hard for him to come back, is my take.
Right. Also had CB Dalloway won over Daniel Sarafian by split decision. And that was an interesting fight, a lot of back and forth there. I think there were a bunch of boos. A lot of people thought Sarafian won that one, but split decision. Gabriel Gonzaga had a nice comeback extension there with a big win over Ben Rothwell. Got a guillotine choke on him in the second round.
Yeah, that one, I just wonder if, you know, Rothwell, I had really given him every chance going into this fight. I mean, he had a new camp, and supposedly this was a slimmed-down version. And I just thought his stand-up looked dreadful. And I remember the first time I'd seen him fight was back 2005 at Fight Night at the Flats up in Cleveland. And he wasn't up against an opponent the caliber of Gonzaga. But the point being that his stand-up was crisp, his boxing was really good. He put it together so good that night. And from what I've seen, he just looked awful. I mean, his elbows were way out. His hands were down protecting his pecs, not his chin. And his stamina looked terrible. And I don't know. To me, he's not evolving. He was de-evolving, my take on it. And, I mean, there's no way to sugarcoat this loss for him either, because there's losses and then there's losses. And I don't know. This has wrecked his momentum, I think, my take on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, usually after a performance like that, Dana White will come out and blast a guy or throw him out. Actually, the UFC does not have a very deep pool of heavyweights. So.
Yeah.
I guess that's where that's probably going to be kept. But we also had Khabib Nurmagomedov fought Thiago Tavares, knocked him out, TKO. From punches and elbows in the first round at the 155 mark. And that was another impressive and good performance from the undefeated Nurmagomedov. And he'll definitely climb the ladder.
Yes.
You test him. But I see him fighting for a title eventually. We had Godofredo Castro beat Milton Vieira, also by split decision. And not sure how controversial that one was, because I didn't see it. We had Ronnie Marks versus Andrew Craig. Marks won by unanimous decision. Nick the Carney Lance beat Diego Nunes in another unanimous decision. Then we had Edson Barboza back on the winning track against Lucas Martins. It was a submission from punches in the first round at the 238 mark. It's always interesting to see. And then we had a no contest between Pedro Nobre and Yuri Alcantara. It was a accidental foul in the first round. Stopped that one. And deep bar submission in round two. Finally, Francisco Trinaldo beat C.J. Keith by arm triangle choke. And we have one of the most stacked three cards I have ever seen coming up on Saturday.
Yes.
UFC on Fox 6, I think.
Yes.
And it's Demetrius Johnson versus John Dodson in the main event there. And we're going to get to the Ultimate Fighter in a few minutes here, but Dodson is a Ultimate Fighter alumni. He didn't win the show, but he might be the first guy to get a title off that that series, that season. He's done pretty well, and this is a good weight for him. And Demetrius Johnson's one of those guys that isn't very dynamic when he fights. He seems to just more not really trying to knock people out. Five rounds almost every time. So I think it's a good fight for John Dodson.
Yeah, and in this one, Dodson is so exciting and just exactly what that division needs. But as you said, Johnson fights, I won't say he doesn't fight to win, but it's more of that play it safe, grind it out. So I guess my heart's with Dotson, but my money would probably be on a decision for Johnson.
I would definitely favor Dotson in this one, just because I think that his relentless style and his striking is just way better than Johnson's, and I don't think Johnson can keep him down as far as, you know, taking him down and trying to wrestle through the whole thing.
Well, I hope it plays out that way, because Dotson is very unconventional. I mean, you've seen his athleticism, and he's one of those kind of guys that he will be hard to prepare for, because he can just do stuff you don't normally see. So I hope you're right.
Well, you're the psychic, so I don't know.
TBD, to be determined.
All right. Well, we also have Quentin Jackson's last fight in the UFC. I think that's pretty much a given there that he's at the end of his contract and he's not coming back. He's fighting Glover Teixeira. And interestingly enough, I didn't read the article, but Teixeira's claimed that he didn't talk any smack about Jackson. You know, Jackson is kind of pissed off at him for some reason and convinced that he has been talking smack. But Jackson comes in at 32-10. Teixeira comes in at 19-2. And Teixeira may not have a lot of experience. He's been in a lot of battles. I've seen him up in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's a pretty good fight. I forget who he fought, but he was like one of the top four fights on that card, and there are some pretty big teams there. And then the ninth fight of the night is actually being considered sort of a sleeper main event and could have some title implications there. We've got Donald Cerrone, 19-4, versus Anthony Pettis, who's 15-2. And Pettis is itching to get a title shot, and if he wins against Cerrone, he'll probably be much closer to that opportunity. And he's kind of dropped off the radar since the big Showtime kick that he landed against Ben Henderson, who will be defending, I think, February 2nd against, Jose Aldo versus Frankie Edgar. We got Eric Koch, 13-1, fighting Ricardo Lamas, who's 12-2. And just looking at some of these records, I can't believe they put this on free TV. I mean, these are just some good matchups here. Also, we got TJ Grant, 19-5, versus Matt Wyman, who's 15-6. And a big matchup here for Clay Guida, coming off his controversial loss to Gray Maynard. He's going down in weight to fight Hatsu Hayuki, who's 26-5-2. Guida is 29-13. And because this fight is in Chicago, Guida will actually get to participate in the coaching of a local, I think it's one of the top high school in the region there, and two of the top two national teams. He's going to be coaching one of them a couple days before this big fight. So actually, probably tonight. So we'll see how he does in his coaching role, and then he'll go right to the fight. But I was one of those people who actually thought Clay had an interesting, albeit not very entertaining, style against Maynard, and I thought he landed way more punches and probably should have won those rounds. I mean, at least if you scored it as a boxing match, which it technically really was, you would think that Guida would have got the win. But Maynard did land a couple nice bombs here and there, so obviously the judges favored effective aggression against strikes landed.
Well, I'm really anxious to see Guida at this weight division. I think this is where he belongs, and I don't think the talent pool is quite as deep. So I've really got my money on him in this one.
And I definitely think he's that much of a fan favorite, too, that he'll have the crowd on his side, and he'll definitely be itching to win this since it's a close title. So we wish him the best of luck there in his new weight class. And we have Ryan Bader, 14-3, versus Vladimir Matyushenko, who's 26-6. Bain is 14-3. It's definitely going to be a good matchup there.
Well, you know, it's funny how I just mentioned the phrase gatekeeper earlier, and I read somewhere that Dana has applied that moniker to Matyushenko. You know, he is the official gatekeeper at 205. Beat him or else. So this is a must-win for Bader.
The janitor?
The janitor is a gatekeeper, yes.
Actually, I learned this in high school somewhere. I think it was in lab class. But janitor comes from the word janus, which I think it means something like eye. So it's like all-seeing eye type of deal. It's something to do with that. But basically, Matyushenko is one of those guys who, he doesn't look all that tough. You know, you get a good look at him, but he definitely puts on some good shows. And to have that many fights, period, is tough to do in MMA. And, you know, 32 fights. That's not as common as it used to be.
Yeah.
But he's definitely one of those guys that the UFC just seems to keep around no matter what. And
you know,
also, just
to back up a second on the Rampage fight, I think the intriguing question is which Quinton is going to show up for this, because he really is motivated to win this thing, because Teixeira is... There's that implication that since he's training at the Pit and he's the protege of Chuck Liddell, that he's the next big thing. And, you know, he'll be an easy marketing job, assuming he can really look good against Jackson. And, you know, Quinton would not want that under any circumstance, so I have to assume he's going to be in shape for it. But yet, there's other times that he says he'll be motivated, and he just hasn't come through. So this is the intriguing fight of the night to me.
Yeah, I would just on paper say that Jackson wins this one, but you never know. I mean, what guy is going to show up? You don't know.
Exactly.
So it could be a lot more interesting than people imagine. But, you know, being that it's his last fight, you know, the way the UFC treats fighters, I would think that he's going to be fighting extra hard to get the mic after this one.
Right.
And speak his mind in front of the crowd. So I kind of hope that he wins just for that opportunity to hear what he has to say as his last words in the octagon. But we got a lot of other big fights on this card too. I don't know how many of these will end up getting shown on TV. I know they like to show the knockouts and stuff after the main event if it's short. So I looking at some of these guys' records, I would think that, you know, most, at least one or two of these early fights will end in a stoppage of some sort that they'll be able to show. But after the Bader fight, we have Mike Russo, 15-2, fighting Sean Jordan, who's 13-4. Both of those guys are up-and-comers, and should be a decent fight there. And then actually, there's a guy fighting who is actually partially responsible for us not having a guest tonight. Pascal Krause, who's 10-1, is actually trained by Duke Rufus, and I was working on trying to get him for tonight's show, but he's busy with like four different guys fighting this weekend, and Krause is one of them. And he's fighting Mike Stumpf, who's 11-3, and I've never heard of that guy, so I don't know if this is his debut or I just haven't seen him fight yet in the UFC. But you know, judging by their records, it's a pretty even match right there. We have Rafael Natal, who's 14-4-1, fighting Sean Spencer, who's 9-1. I know I've heard of Natal, but I have not seen or heard of Spencer. David Mitchell, 11-2, finally in their first fight of the night here, fighting Simeon Thorson, 17-3-1. So overall, there isn't a single guy, and that's a guy who's 9-1. So that's pretty impressive. And the top number of wins is Rampage 32. But a lot of guys with wins in the 20s here. It's 26 wins for Aoki, 29 for Guida, 26 wins for Matyushenko. So guys with a lot of experiences, and most of them with very few losses. That's the big thing about this card. There's not just the majority of this card has under 5 losses. So you're going to see a lot of each other in this one. And, of course, we just had the airing of the Oaks.
Dana's comments when he's watching the elimination fights, like you remember he said about that one guy, he says, boy, that guy looks like he has a few bodies in his basement, you know. And I thought about that, and I said, yeah, exactly. That's a very, very accurate description.
Well, he had an appropriate nickname, too. Strangler or something. Yeah, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But, the fighters, I know that they're all getting bonuses. I think they did this the last season, too, but everybody gets a $5,000 bonus for a stoppage win, whether it be submission, knockout. Either way, they get a stoppage bonus. Then they also get $25,000 for submission of the season, fight of the season, and knockout of the season. Like I said, they had their families there, which was a first. And that's really a key to the reality series format. And actually, there's a story that I'll get to in a minute here about the ratings that vastly improved for this debut. Like I said, it started on a different day of the season, Tuesday, which is it's not very crowded with other programming that the demographic that they're looking for is going to be watching instead of The Ultimate Fighter. And I think it shows I don't really watch too much stuff on Tuesday, but I did notice I was talking about the Discovery Channel when it was on Friday, and their show's on Friday, and I just noticed the other day the Discovery Channel is actually number one on Fridays right now, so it's a good thing that they didn't pick that number one network for Friday nights. Definitely a bad idea for Tuff to try it on Fridays, but they fixed it. So it's Tuesday night now. There's not a lot of other MMA stuff going on that night. And Bellator is, I think, on Thursday, so they don't have to worry about that. And I'm not sure. I think they might have a Wednesday show, too, on Spike for Bellator. But it's going to start at 9 normally. It's this last episode of Tough number 17 for the season number 17. Drew over 1.51 million viewers on this slot.
Whoa.
Getting the Nielsen ratings. And that's their highest TV ratings yet since moving to the FX network in January of 2012. And FX also noted significant improvement in the key advertising demographics, including adults 18 to 49 and men 18 to 49. Tough season was a series debut on FX, and it opened strong, pulling in 1.3 million viewers for the premiere episode, but declined throughout the season as the live format fell flat with most viewers, who also didn't warm up to the Friday night time slot. And they went back to the tried-and-true pre-recorded format for season 16, but ratings declined even further, also due to the Friday night run. The article even mentions it's a night that a significant portion of the show's key demographic isn't all that likely to stay home to watch television. So not only is there a competition with other networks, but it's not a good day for young guys and girls who like to be out drinking and partying. But the UFC on Fox television deal, which encompasses FX, came together quickly and has been a constant work in progress. And The Ultimate Fighter is chief among the projects received changes. John Jones and Chael Sonnen have a lot to do with it. Picking those guys as coaches, knowing that they both have controversy in their background, Jones with the DUI, Chael Sonnen with multiple issues. He's got the testosterone exemptions, the suspension for being over the limit, the legal problems he's had. There's all kinds of things that you could.
Half the country in Brazil wants to see him. Wow, I mean, some of the stuff he said about Brazil, he's got half the country there after his neck. So, yeah, Mr. Controversy.
Right. And there's another story I'm going to get to about how his act is sort of toned down for this Tough series. And there was an article written on both Sonnen and Nick Diaz and how they've changed recently in supply theory as to why, but I think I have one, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But the most significant new improvement for this Tough series is the new time slot. And at 9 Eastern, it's a much more appealing night and time for most fans. And basically, a lot of past criticisms are targeted at the show's stagnating format, focusing almost solely on juvenile antics in the fights, while the Tough 17 series put way more emphasis on trying to get more viewers attached to the fighters by way of getting the family involved. And the fighters this season to have the family and friends in Las Vegas to watch the elimination fights. And it worked great for the UFC because, you know, their majority owners are the Fertittas, and they own Station Casinos, so they got a lot of free advertising for Station Casinos that they
have.
These fighters. Palace Station was one of the hotel that they put everybody up in. They kept showing the front entrance and the big Palace Station sign. So, you know, they killed two birds with one stone on that one. But from The Biggest Loser to Survivor to American Idol, if you can get the viewer to somehow empathize or connect with the personalities, they're much more likely to return to see how those guys do. And, you know, it works both ways. You know, you got guys that have a cocky attitude, and you turn into to watch them lose.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But getting to the actual fights and fighters, I think we saw a lot of guys that win or lose the competition. They'll end up fighting in the UFC. And actually, Chael Sonnen has done a few interviews since being on the show. And not quite as enthusiastic as Dana White, who actually said, what am I going to do, put the winner of this against Anderson Silva for the title? You know, because there's that many good guys. But Chael says there are some really tough guys, and a lot of people are going to be surprised by some of them. And there really was a really international feel to this tryout this year. Probably the best performance by somebody from outside the country was Thor Trong from Sweden. And,
yeah, what a surprise he was, yeah.
He's 29 years old, he's 6'2", and his quote was probably one of the most interesting quotes in the book here, too. He says, I've trained for this my whole life, I'm ready to show what Swedish steel is all about. And his record in MMA is
54-1. And you know, his nickname has to be the Hammer, Thor's Hammer, right? Yeah, that's so fitting, yeah. I like it.
The MMA specialty they list is well-rounded. He's actually one of the most experienced guys on the show. The only guy that has more wins on his record is Bubba McDaniel, who was a friend of John Jones and got picked by John Jones as a result. Yeah, Robert McDaniel.
And he was picked fourth, by the way, too. That was kind of interesting. Did you notice that? He was picked fourth. Okay.
Yes, he was. Zachary Cummings, who also won pretty quickly in his fight and had a pretty decent showing, is also a guy to watch. He knocked. They were talking about it might have been the quickest knockout in Tough history. He just threw a right hand at a guy that was actually from Vegas, working in the nightclubs out there in Vegas, and Nick Sacchetti. He's only 5-1. He's 15-3. It was so quick, but he hit him so hard his eyes swelled right up after the fight. So Zach Cummings is definitely somebody that I'm going to be watching. I'm actually trying to get an interview with him for the story in the magazine. But he's coming in with a 15-3 record too, so he's pretty comparable to Thor. But Thor has a few more fights to him overall. Another guy is definitely worth watching. I don't know if he's any related to Devin from the Chicago Bears, but Clint Hester from Atlanta, Georgia, just a tough little guy. Doesn't even look like he's tall enough or big enough to be a 185-pounder when you first look at him. But he's actually 6'2". His record is 7-3, and really showed a lot of promise. Took him a while to win the fight. He seemed to be really in control. Actually, John Jones had to tell him to settle down at one point. Exerting too much energy. Then there's one guy from Massachusetts, Jimmy Quinlan, who is coming in at 3-0. But But he definitely looked very impressive with his wrestling in particular. And he's also specialized in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And he was actually the only guy from Massachusetts in the whole series. Like, not just the only guy to win his fight. But, this time they only had one guy from Mass. Typically, I think they try to, you know, get at least one guy from the New England area. But, you know, in past years they've had a couple, two or three guys. This year they only had one. He's the only guy from New England, period. So I'm definitely going to be rooting for him as a Massachusetts native. And we also, Bubba McDaniel looks all right in the fight, but John Jones said it best, I think. You know, it all depends on which guy shows up, you know, which Bubba is going to show up. Some days he's unstoppable in training, some days he's kind of flat. But, you know, I think you're going to see over the course of the series that, you know, he's got a lot of experience and stuff like that, but his attitude needs a little bit of improvement. I don't want to reveal about what everybody hasn't seen, but you'll see what I'm talking about after the series advances.
Well, I kind of got that impression when it showed him in the hotel room there in his... You know, it was just, a guy just seemed like he was just not grounded. And this is the wrong activity to be in if you're not grounded. So we'll see what happens.
The guy really impressed me, some stories, 5-0 from London, Luke Barnett. Did not look very good in his fight. He seemed to struggle with the boxing, ended up with a nice shiner at the end of it. But this is a guy who was a marketing executive, wearing a suit and tie to work every day, and decided one day, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm going to give up this big money, and I'm going to go live in an MMA gym. And so that's what he did, and said never before in his life was he ever just good at something, and he felt that way about MMA. And it really changed him for the better. I think he's a very down-to-earth guy, very humble. You know, he's to get picked first for Team Sonnen there. He said he'd never been picked for anything first in his life, so
yeah,
it was a big highlight of his career to have that happen. And he looks good. I mean, I think he's going to go far in this series. He's 6 foot somewhere in the house, so that's going to help him. And really, like I said, he had some weak striking, more so boxing. He does like to throw knees and little kicks here and there, but I think once Chael Sonnen gets onto him and really, you know, has his coaches work with him a little bit more, I think you're going to see Luke Barnett make a run at this tournament. Finals. He's going to be in the finals for sure, I think. But we'll see how it goes. Another guy I wanted to mention, of course, was Uriah Hall, a Jamaican native who moved to New York City. He's age 28, and his record is 7-2. And you know, they really searched far and wide for these competitors this year. And watching his fight, I had the feeling that he's probably really a huge fan of John Jones. And then, of course, when he didn't get picked by John Jones, he mentioned that he really likes how John Jones fights.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
So, but he was confident. He said, you know, everything happens for a reason, so he was kind of satisfied about that. But I don't know how he's going to do, but one little thing I noticed, they showed his fight that he's going to have. They showed clips of his fight, and there was a moment where Dana White turns around and he's like speechless after he sees this knockout. And I think, I mean, doing my little detective work from watching that, I think you see a black guy get put into the ambulance. So not 100% sure, but I think that's Uriah Hall. So I think he's gonna, I don't know, in this one, but don't quote me. But Uriah Hall was definitely, he looked good in his first fight, but he was a little bit sloppy in certain areas. I think he just, he ran up against a good competitor, too, Andy Enns. He was 6-1. There was only a couple guys who lost in the preliminary fights who I would have loved to see get onto the show anyway, and Andy Enns was one of them. Uriah Hall was definitely a good sport because he came right up with Bull Family, and he told Hank, don't ever give up, and he told him he was tough. He's a real tough guy, so class act there on his part.
Yes, I agree.
And we also had Gilbert Smith Jr. from Colorado Springs. He's 5-1. He looks pretty decent. And he had one of the best quotes in the first episode there when he was talking to his family. You should never be afraid of your dreams. And it almost brought him to tears when he was talking about it. So that's whole family. That was a good point, too. You shouldn't be afraid of your dreams. But a lot of people are, especially in that situation. The other guy probably should get another chance at some point. Timothy Williams, Millville, New Jersey, called the Sister Strangler. That was the guy that has the bodies in the basement.
Yeah.
He came in at 7-1, 26 years old, 6'2". And his quote about why he thought he'd become the winner: I am a hard worker and dedicated athlete. I feel that I am constantly growing and improving on all areas of my game. Nothing can stop me. Well, something did stop you, but I think that he'll end up doing all right in the long run. Probably his way to the UFC, a different route. But anyway, next week of XC, Gilbert Smith Jr. fighting Luke Barnett. So even though I've already seen it, I can definitely, I can't really say anything about it. But I can definitely say it's a good episode. Watching. It's a very tough episode. You learn a lot about a lot of these guys, including the coaches. But there's another article I did. Yes, and Chael Sonnen. And how do you. Nick Diaz actually complimented. In the past after so kind of a tough person to interview, and of course Chael Sonnen, like we said, was very controversial. Actually at one point demanded that Anderson Silva's wife cook him a steak. He does have that pro wrestling type of mentality, trying to hype fights and stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember he said there's something about cooking the steak after he had touched her inappropriately or slapped her inappropriately or something,
Yeah. And Nick Diaz actually suffers from anxiety disorder, too. So that's apparently why he feels he needs medical marijuana. And he's coming off that suspension. But he's still one of the sport's most compelling figures. And it's kind of like people want to watch him not just for his fighting ability, but the whole part of his character. That's a little bit disturbing, but it's entertaining at the same time. You know, and like I said, I've seen him on interviews where you can see in his mannerisms that he is really afraid to be in an interview. And it's just one of those things where he definitely, he's not lying about having anxiety, it's for sure. But this article talks about how there is no show here. You know, Nick Diaz is on time to the press conference and positively reinforcing his opponent, and Chael Sonnen is showing respect for his opponent, John Jones. He came right into the show, introduced himself to them, and kind of hands it up with him a little bit during the preliminary fights. My theory is the Fox connection, especially with Trump, and also the union, the culinary union, putting all the pressure on the UFC to warm up to the kids and be more less offensive, actually. think that pressure had a lot to do with it, because Fox is more of a family type of station, and I think that they're trying to make sure that you know, that kind of antics, those kind of antics like you know, Sonnen can get involved in aren't part of the show and don't damage the reputation of the network. That's just my theory. I don't know why, but I would think that the UFC probably did talk to both Diaz and Sonnen, and maybe they didn't threaten to fine him or anything, but they definitely put the kibosh on that stuff and said, tone it down. That's just
yeah.
So, until next week, thanks for stopping by, everybody. And enjoy the fights. Big fights this weekend.
All right, guys, let's enjoy the fights.
Yeah, I know we don't. We got as much time as we want to say goodbye. I forgot about that. But anyway. Yeah, that's going to be worth watching to see if Chael Sonnen ends up, you know, being a big ass down the line, or actually does a complete turnaround and tries to gain more fans by being a little more reserved. So I guess that'll do it for us tonight, and I definitely am looking forward to the big fights on Fox here. It's probably one of the best free cards we're going to see in a while, so.
All right, lots to talk about next week. Can't wait. Talk to you guys then.
Sure, and we'll be trying to get Duke Rufus in for next week. So look out for that. Look out for an announcement on that. And hopefully we'll be able to use some of these tidbits from some of the interviews that I'm going to do with these the Ultimate Fighter guys and coaches on the show.
I will likely do the show on the road next week. We have a strange tradition in Philadelphia. The Friday before the Super Bowl, when about 20,000 people pack the Wells Fargo Center with the Flyers and Sixers play, we watch people gorge on chicken wings. And it's called the Wing Bowl. Most people get there about 12 to 2 in the morning. The event starts at 7. It's usually over by 9:30. I'm going this year. I got 4 passes with some friends, so. What we're probably going to do is I'm probably going to leave my house around 8-ish, have the phone on my speaker in the car, go down to my friend's house, leave the rest of the show there, and then we're going to wait to leave. Now, what's funny is I was looking at the contestants for this year, and I saw the one guy, his name was like Tiger Wings and Things and whatever, and I'm like, God, he looks familiar. I happen to see a former pro fighter that I've covered. He's unlimited. And I actually emailed him, and I was like, "How are you, kid?" And I was like, "Yo," and I'm like, "I didn't know you were going to be in the Wing Bowl." I mean, we did a bullshit rule, but I sent him one of the articles I wrote on one of his fights from back in 2007. And he's like, "He's an Italian kid." And it's funny. I'm going with an Italian team down there. I'm wearing one of my big goofy red, white, and green hats, and I always wear Mardi Gras beads when I go. So I got red, white, and green beads to wear.
Nice. Well, and Eric, I hope they ordered their wings in advance, because there's a big story going around the news networks that there's a huge shortage of chicken wings this year because they didn't produce enough chickens. That was back to the corn shortage. They didn't have corn to feed them, so they didn't raise enough chickens last year as they should have. So a huge wing shortage, and the price is going way up. So I hope they ordered their wings in advance. Run out. All right, guys. That's it for us.
Okay, next week.
See you later.